Need to move some.
This Three Beards Media podcast may contain mature themes, and if you're not down with that, we got three words for you: like the podcast. Nailed it!
Welcome, everybody, to Episode 8 of False Starts with Bill Blank and Chris Shipley. I am your host, Chris Shipley, as always, joined by Bill. Bill, how are you doing tonight?
Swell. How are you? I'm a little annoyed that somebody right next to my windows is deciding to get out the trimmer and trim up their lawn, so hopefully that's not too big of a...
It's actually fairly quiet right now. I was going to complain, like, who would mow their lawn at 8 o'clock? But when the earth is scorching hot at any time during the day, I can understand.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. I get it. I should maybe put a sign outside that says I'm recording a podcast. Can you not do anything in or around my house for the next hour and a half?
Every other Monday?
Yeah.
Right. Well, we have a really special guest tonight. I'm super excited to bring this on. Obviously, important topic, and you know, we don't necessarily just celebrate Pride Month here at Three Beards Media. We have a lot of content containers that are supportive. We're supportive, but obviously June is Pride Month, and we wanted to kind of wrap that around tonight's episode. So we were kind enough to last minute ask this gentleman to come on. So I'd like to introduce CJ Peterson to the podcast. CJ, thank you again for agreeing to come on False Starts.
Yeah, thank you, Chris and Bill. I appreciate you both having me on.
Yeah, so for those that don't know, CJ, I kind of ran across you on Twitter last year during the midterm elections is when I kind of caught sight of you working on the Democratic side. But there's a lot more to you. Why don't you kind of introduce yourself to our audience and fill in the gaps, because I'm absolutely terrible at that.
Yeah, so I grew up in Southwest Iowa, a rural kid. So, grew up, with a single mom, parents were separated and all that jazz. I got involved in politics at a pretty young age. I was out working. I ran my first county supervisor race when I was 16 years old. I knocked doors and, you know, worked for a Republican who was challenging a different Republican. And we beat the incumbent then. And I just have stuck around politics ever since. So worked for a lot of different candidates, including Bernie Sanders, a lot of different ones. And then I was on the U.S. Senate race last summer. And that's probably when you and I crossed paths. But really just... like to help people who want to help people. So
what what got you to run for Senate? What were you doing before you ran for Senate, and then what kicked you in the ass, so to speak, to get you to like just take that next step?
Yeah, so in 2020 I ran for the state Senate, which is my state Senate district is in Western Iowa. And what I notice is in a lot of these places around rural Iowa and rural parts of the Midwest, you have candidates on one side of the political aisle who run unopposed. And they say a lot of things that can hurt a lot of people, especially kids, especially people who need to hear more affirming language. I see a lot of it with the attacks on kids who, already are having a hard enough time, getting through middle school, right? Middle school's hard enough. And then you're going to take, a part of who they are that they're struggling to figure out, and then use that as another way to attack them and make it harder for them to get by. So with that in mind, I decided to run for state Senate in 2020. I live in a very, very red district, so there was no shot that I was going to win that race, but it was just something that, for the people who needed something to vote for, to believe in, or what have you, you got to step up and say something. So, and then in 2022, I was working on a U.S. Senate race for a candidate named Mike Franken that ran for U.S. Senate.
Nice. So, how, you know, Chris obviously filled you in on how, you know, our show is about, you know, mental health and getting, you know, that out into the forefront, especially for men to just openly talk about it. And like, I just got done with therapy an hour and a half ago. So just, you know, the encouragement and everything. What, during that process of running for state Senate, I imagine you probably got a lot of hate, you know, especially from, you know, the district, maybe even from people you grew up with, maybe even people you actually knew. What was that like for you mentally? What did you do to cope? Or did you, you know, kind of just ignore it?
Yeah, so I can't be enough of a champion of therapy and making sure that you are talking to the, you know, the right professional for you, you know, whether it's a, you know, I prefer therapy online. I use an app called BetterHelp, and I, you know, I can chat with them. Sometimes I send a, you know, 10-page long email, and then they respond to me 2 days later. And then by that point, I already feel better, but being able to send them something made me
sure.
And so, or whether it's the traditional, you know, in person, I just think that's important. So I guess to answer your question, my first brush with mental health that I was aware of was probably when I was a junior in high school. My dad actually attempted suicide. And we, at that time, I remember, you know, it was very surreal for me because at the time I didn't really understand all the issues. And I had no idea that there was anything, you know, going on with him and in his mind. And, you know, he was always kind of a pretty closed off guy. And for me, I remember having to really get past the fact that I was really angry at him for you know, quote unquote, to my knowledge, trying to leave, right? He was trying to leave me behind. And
felt selfish.
So yes, it felt selfish to me at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as an adult, you know, we've gone through some similar struggles with my dad. You know, he's struggles with bipolar depression and several different diagnoses. But anyway, long story short, I then in my 20s, I struggled with substance use disorder, and I ended up in treatment and have been sober now for about 6 years. But I just, it's all co-occurring. And so for me, it was just, I have to handle every day when it comes. And I think that just taking it day by day really is what helps get through things like that. And I just think there's no shame in feeling like if somebody's being, you know, a jerk to you or making you feel crappy about yourself, that it's okay to feel what you're feeling. And it's okay to like acknowledge that it sucks. I think that was the biggest thing, is I didn't always put on a smiley face about it. I said, hey, yeah, this is kind of crappy, you know.
Being tuned into the politics of this state and the state of where we're at in Iowa, with it turning more red and things like that, you're probably more tuned into resources that are available through the state as far as mental health goes and things like that. And I think that that's also been kind of deviated a little bit from too. How do you feel about how things are going as far as the state level here and what helps out there?
Yeah, I mean, we have, what, $300 million in the state bank account right now that's above and beyond what we actually need to pay the state's bills, right? And it's just stockpiled money. And yet we still have people being turned away or you know, quote-unquote, referred to other services. And you know, Audubon County, where I live, you know, if you need a mental health bed, they basically put you in what's traditionally just a hospital room, right? Like then they'll keep you there for 48 hours, but then if you don't, they can't find you anywhere to go, you know, usually it's Broadlawns in Des Moines or something like that. Right. I mean, I don't think that the policymakers in, you know, Des Moines or even in Washington understand the depth or the breadth of the problem. I mean, it's not just about the money, but it's really a lot of it's about the money, you know, and it's just, there's just not an infrastructure there. You know, I mean, it's not to the point where, you know, you look at breast cancer 30 years ago, and breast cancer was something that we as a society decided that we wanted to work on. And so we created Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and we created all these, you know, runs and walks and awareness drives, and we made it, you know, we made it where it wasn't shameful for people to talk about having breast cancer. And now breast cancer is now not necessarily a death sentence anymore. And it's, I would like to see us treat mental health the same way that we treat, you know, breast cancer or other forms of illness. And, you know, if somebody gets lung cancer from smoking, we don't tell them that, you know, they knew smoking was bad for them and they deserve to die, right? But when somebody is addicted to a substance and it causes some co-occurring mental health issues, or it's as a result of co-occurring mental health, you know, we tend to assign blame for some of that. And so, yeah, sorry, I'll let you talk, but I just...
No, the best guests are the ones that keep talking. So, I mean, don't feel like you have to stop.
No, absolutely. That's, you know, we want passionate people, and we want you to, we get to talk all we want. You're the special one. So, yeah, I mean, to kind of backtrack a bit. So during, you know, when you were running for state Senate, specifically that time. Yeah. How did you cope with the opposing, you know, the attacks? And, you know, I'm sure you probably got things privately, private messages that were gross. And how did you cope with that mentally during that time?
You know, I don't think there's anything that could have prepared me for the first time I got a message calling me, you know, a gay slur. I just was actually astonished, because growing up in, you know, the 21st century and coming of age in this time, you don't really think that stuff is still out there. But it was, and that was the first time I really realized that some of this cultural backlash that we're seeing it was real, and it was actually hitting home for me. And I mean, I'm a pretty secure person in my own skin, but you know, when people are constantly attacking you, or they're, you know, questioning your motives, or they're acting as if you're, you know, doing something wrong by, you know, being who you are, or saying, you know, why do you need to tell us that you're gay if you're running for office, blah blah blah. It's like, I never told anybody I was gay. I said, this is my husband, right? So like, you decided that I was making it about my sexuality. I just said, this is my husband, just as any other candidate. And my opponent actually said, I have a wife and three kids, right? So I mean, no different. And so it's just kind of a double standard there that was applied. And the thing that I did to cope was, I just, number one, I don't think it's really helpful to argue or get into a back and forth with people who are attacking you from a place of hate, because they're obviously going through something that is making them feel a desire to say something to another person. I have not, maybe it'll happen someday in my life, I don't know, I hope not, but I've never felt the urge to just like get in somebody's inbox and tell them that I thought that they didn't deserve to live, right? Like, I just don't understand what drives a person to do that, but I think that it comes from a place of, they're not well. And I think that empathy in that situation, and just letting them be themselves, you know, they're obviously going through some things, and you know, I was going through some things as well because of what they were doing. And so I think that at some point you have to realize that in life, it's sometimes it's easier to be happy than to be right. And, or even if happy, you know, the absence of conflict sometimes feels better than, you know, getting in the fight. I mean, we have that urge, that human urge to defend ourselves. And so in the moment, I mean, I would always cope by, you know, sometimes I'd screenshot it and send it to my husband and say, look at this shit. You know?
Yeah.
It's just one of those things where I can't tell every person how they're supposed to react, because everybody's going to have a different feeling when something like that comes at you. It doesn't really bother me anymore. I've been called a lot of things, and the thing that bothered me more was not the private messages, it was the public comments, because there's one young adult now who was a teenager and was, you know, in high school at the time, and had been doing a report on my state Senate race, right? And they saw some of the hateful stuff that was happening, and they happened to be not out of the closet yet, and they were still, you know, in the closet, and have since come out, and they're a very happy person. You know, really found strength to be out and proud and love who they are. But when I think about that, and I wonder if there, you know, how many other kids like them might have seen some of that. I mean, it's like I tell people all the time, you know, and I can say this on people on Twitter love to call Kim Reynolds a drunk. And to me, as someone who dislikes her politics, Kim Reynolds getting sober and finding her way in life and overcoming that is like the best thing about her, right? Like, that's something I admire and respect about her. And so she's not going to see the tweets that people are making, because she has political campaign people who run those accounts, right? Mm-hmm. The nasty things you say. I didn't feel the mean and nasty things. But followed me, people who are struggling saw those things. And so you have to think about, when you're attacking someone, whether it's a politician or it's a, you know, a public figure or even somebody down the street, you're not just attacking them. You're making a statement about who you are to the people that know you also. Mm-hmm. Even if they're not the target of your ire, you're attacking.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that makes perfect sense. I mean, a lot of times, you know, as I got older, when it came to social media and stuff like that, I've always had some strong opinions one way or the other about different things. But a lot of times I say to myself, you know, what's the benefit of me voicing my opinion right now?
Right.
And nine times out of 10, there is none.
I mean, I have a question. I mean, when's the last time you changed your mind because somebody told you you were stupid?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What are we doing here? Right.
Yeah.
Last time my dad yelled at me.
Yeah.
I feel the same way as Bill. There's a lot of times that I will probably put the phone down and go, this response or what I'm going to tape out here is not going to make a difference. But there have been a few times, even in this last week, where I've seen some things that I just have had. I think sometimes I comment just because I feel like somebody has to say something. Right. I don't necessarily think I'm going to change anybody's mind, but I feel sometimes like, if maybe similar to what you did when you ran for state Senate, if somebody's running unopposed, then the people that feel like they have a voice with a different opinion is not represented. And I kind of feel that way sometimes when I respond, like, no, I'm not going to change this person's idea, but there are other people out there that feel the same way that I do. And if they see me say something or whatever, then maybe they feel strong enough to be open about how they feel about it as well.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's a slippery slope, you know, because sometimes you walk this thin line between actually feeling the need to be heard or whatever and grandstanding.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like, am I doing this because, like, you know, I can't even remember, this is how bad I am. I can't even remember what it was we were voting for a while back, but it was a local election of some kind, and it was post Roe v. Wade being overturned. And I put in my on Facebook or whatever, I put up a post where I said, today I voted for my nieces to all have control of their own bodies in perpetuity. And a couple of people like called me out, like I was grandstanding, right? Like, you know, what's the point? Okay. So you did, what's the point of, you know, saying anything publicly about it? And I'm just kind of like, well, just because I'm a dude, like, and I'm a middle-aged white guy. Mm-hmm. And as a middle-aged white guy, most people don't think I would feel this way. Mm-hmm. So I kind of want people to know that I do.
I mean, and not to stereotype, but like if I saw you at the grocery store, you know, I probably assume that you thought differently about politics than I do, right? Like,
yeah.
And that's just stereotyping. Like, we shouldn't do it, but it happens, right? So,
well, yeah, I look like Hitler's wet dream right now. Like, I get it. But yeah, I know. And the thing is, there probably are things, you know, I've always considered myself, you know, more of an independent, like I used to say that I was a libertarian, but that kind of got to where it felt like I look like this. Like, I don't think that there's necessarily a bunch of people that are libertarians that are racist or anything like that. Because the general sense is like, leave the government out of my life. Right. Let me do what I want as long as I'm not hurting anybody, and leave me alone. And that's what attracted me to it, but it turned into this a whole bunch of shit that I don't agree with. So but the point is, I always considered myself kind of fiscally conservative, but socially liberal. And I feel like most rational people kind of fall in that category somewhat. Although I don't necessarily believe, I still believe in entitlement programs. So that doesn't necessarily make me a fiscal conservative, I guess. But I do think that we pay too many taxes that I don't think are necessary. You know, I mean, we could have our roads and have our things without it, is my point.
Yeah. I think that's interesting. I feel like every young white guy probably goes through that libertarian phase, because like I definitely had a libertarian phase. It was like in between Republican and Democrat.
It was damn like, the man. It was like
yeah. Well, it's just like, you know, I as a person who was raised more conservative, I started to meet people who were different from me, I started to realize, well, maybe I wasn't so socially conservative. Like, I just didn't care because, you know, I met some people who were cool and they were immigrants and they were, you know, or they were Muslim or whatever. And I was just like, oh, well, this isn't actually what it looks like on Fox News sometimes. And, you know, and I started to realize that the world was bigger than what I had seen in my small hometown. Right. And then it just kind of snowballed from there, right? So I don't know. I think that's pretty common, like, life experience. And I think that one thing that I think both political parties could probably benefit from is recognizing that not everything is super, like, black and white all the time.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
100%. And one great example, like, we talk about the hateful stuff that came out of the legislature that can hurt, you know, kids' mental health and everything, but that's actually a very small percentage of what the state legislature in Iowa does. Like, most of the things they do are passed like 85, 90 to nothing, right? Like, it's all like, you know, non-controversial stuff. So, I mean, most of the time they get along on things, but then on some of these big things, like, you know, not to say
hot button things anyway.
Well, those things don't sell.
Things that get them elected or not elected.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, making regulations about hair salons to make it easier for people to cut hair doesn't really, like, nobody votes on that, right? Like,
yeah.
So, I mean, but those things do help make people's lives better. It's just, I just wish that we would focus on those things and do the things that government is supposed to do. I just don't feel like government should be in my bedroom or in my wallet all the time. And
100%.
Like, at all in my bedroom, hopefully, but, you know, I know Uncle Sam, like, monitors my sleep now through my Apple Watch or whatever. But I don't know. It's like, oh, yeah.
Not if you wear a tinfoil hat to bed.
Oh,
right. That's all you got to do. Yeah. Or those new Apple goggles that they're going to come out for $3,500.
Yeah. I've been wearing the Saran Wrap hat. I thought that would work. But, yeah.
No, that you slips over the nose and then everybody thinks you committed suicide. That's what we're trying to stay away from here.
That's right.
So I don't really need a sleep apnea machine. I just need to stop sleeping with the...
Sorry. Yeah, stop That's sleeping right. plastic over your face. Really good. It's a really good place to start.
Okay, well, that's... All right.
Let's get this last question from Denny in this segment, and then we'll move on. But is there any movement in returning maybe more of an emphasis on mental health? Do you see that movement coming?
So I think that one thing that's interesting is we're seeing politicians in both political parties talk about mental health more. And I think just having it in the ether, in the political conversation, is super important. Because if politicians aren't talking about it, then there's nothing that's actually, you know, getting done, right? Like, I mean, you take climate change, for example, only Democrats are talking about that. So nothing's ever going to get done on it until both parties start acknowledging something about it. But with mental health, they're both starting to talk about it, which means there's going to be some
middle ground at some
point. Yeah, there's going to be some point at which, you know, they're going to be able to sit with the health experts and figure out what works. And I think that that's some reason to have some hope. And it's becoming unsustainable because it's not just, you know, liberal people or conservative people who lose children to suicide, or, you know, have a cousin who is struggling with, you know, addiction or what have you. So, I mean, conservatives and liberals both, and people in the middle, they all have someone's been touched by this crisis, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think there is reason to have hope. So,
yeah.
But one would think, like, you know, like you said, you know, people love to call Kim Reynolds a drunk, and, you know, one would think she would be more, you know, mental health savvy when, I mean, she's basically, I mean, how many places has she closed since she's been in office? Mental health facilities, you know, what have you, you know, I mean, obviously she's familiar with addiction. Do you think that she doesn't relate alcohol addiction to mental health? Do you think she separates the two?
So here's my theory on this, if I may, and I want to, you know, qualify this with saying that I am not a mental health professional, and I have not evaluated Kim Reynolds in a clinical setting, but I do think that I do think that she may approach the alcohol use from a position of moral failing rather than, you know, a mental health concern, and that's a common feature of 12-step programs, right? You know, and even though the 12-step programs do have elements that allow you to kind of process your feelings and go through the steps of talking to people and making amends and all of that, I think there is a focus on some of the moral failing aspect of it. And so I think that that could be a factor in the way that the governor views those things. But again, I don't know what's in her heart or in her head, but
AA tends to be religious. It's not necessarily meant to be anything singular, but, you know, they talk about a God of your understanding or whatever, but you find everything. 90% of the people that talk in that way in those meetings talk about Jesus and God and whatever else. So I could see that, because I don't get I'm trying to find the disconnect. Like, I think a lot of it just is party affiliation. It just comes down to what's going to keep me in office. And that's where I feel like politicians fail. I feel like once they get in office, they spend 90% of their time making sure they stay there rather than getting actual work done.
Oh, I can vouch for that 100%. I've seen it up close and personal. So I do think... I do think there's that weird disconnect. And I think that sometimes, instead of, you know, calling people out for that, it's better to call them in and tell them our stories. And, you know, and I read a story during the legislative session about a parent of a transgender child who went and sat down with the governor and tried to convince the governor not to sign the bill that was going to, you know, hurt his child. And, you know, it didn't work, but the person was happy that she was willing to talk to him. I don't know. I just think that some more of that, but I can't tell people how they should process that kind of, you know, I guess, attack.
It feels like there has to be trauma. Like, it feels like there has to be, you know, some sort of trauma bonding even.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, you end up in the same elevator during a tornado, or, you know, with a transgender kid, or
right.
But for me, you know, but also, I don't know, something has to, like, my one of the things that really got me thinking differently as a child, you know, as like a young teenager, was my sister's best friend, was a lesbian. Well, I didn't know that. And all my sister's friends treated me like shit, treated me like my sister did, you know? And I mean, kid stuff, not like I have this thing. I love my sister, but anyway, her best friend was the only one that was nice to me and was always nice to me. And so then I found out a couple years later that she was gay, and my head clicked immediately. And I was like, am I supposed to stop? I love this person. Mm-hmm. Am I supposed to not love them now? That doesn't make any sense to me. So right. That was my click moment. But I think it has to be harsher for some people.
Yeah. Well, and I'm at a point now where like, I don't have any more patience for justifying my own existence. Or like, sure. And I'm at a point where, you know, gay, trans, bisexual, lesbian, you know, whoever, we all have to occupy the space that we can, because there's less and less of it now for us. And for me, you know, there's all this talk of like, oh, we were fine with Pride until you started having kids at Pride or blah, blah, blah. That's not true. I mean, Anita Bryant was doing this crap back in the 70s, right? Like, I mean, this has all been happening for decades. Like, mm-hmm. it's not like it was fine and then now it's not. Like, I mean, it's just for about 4 or 5 years, it started to become socially unacceptable to be like that. Mm-hmm. And then there's this backlash, right? So that's what happens with societal change, too. I mean,
pendulum swinging.
Yes, exactly.
Those are the extremes. So
yeah. We start to become more accepting, and then we snap back. You know, you saw it in the counterculture of the 60s, and you see it in the 80s with the, you know, the AIDS crisis and all of that. And, you know, you see it through all these different things that we've gone through as a society, and we always do come out better on the other side. It's just my concern is for the people who are living in it right now, because not everybody is doing as well as I am. Like, I can live in rural white Iowa, like in rural Western Iowa with my husband on a farm, and we can go out to lunch at the diner and nobody assumes that there's something going on between us, because we both just present as, you know, masculine looking, presenting white men, right? Like, we're just two guys having lunch. Like, there are people who, because of who they are and things that they can't change about themselves, they just happen to be more feminine presenting, or they are kind of more androgynous or in between presenting, you know, and so it's hard, it makes it more, they become more of a target. And so I have a, you know, people who look like me have a privilege to live in these rural areas, but I also understand when my friends, you know, some of my friends from the city who are, you know, black and transgender, they say, oh, I'm not going out to your place because if I have to stop for gas somewhere, I'm
going to stand out like a sore thumb, you know.
Right, right. And so I think that it's the responsibility in some ways of some of us who have a little more privilege to use that. You know, it's like in politics, we call it political capital. But if we use a little bit of that on the behalf of people who need it, I think that's important. And I think it's important to just talk about this as a mental health issue more than just you know, the civil rights aspect of it, because I think sometimes that issue doesn't compute to people. It doesn't matter to them until mm-hmm. there's a personal story attached, and that just sucks, but that's just how it is.
Well, but it's also hard though too, because when you say talk about this as a mental health issue, what you mean is, you know, let's make sure we're treating these people right. Yep. for the sake of their mental health.
Yeah.
Whereas someone on the other side is going to say, this is a mental health issue. Right. These people are sick.
Yeah,
that's why a male is a male and a female is a female, you know, and they do all that kind of stuff.
Well, and
I don't understand the motivation personally. Like, what is the motivation for someone to speak out so wholeheartedly against this?
At the end of the day, I think that people are motivated against things that they don't understand or that they feel shame about themselves. And that's why, you know, 9 out of 10 anti-gay politicians gets caught in a bathroom somewhere, right? Like,
I love that. I love talking about that. I talk about that on stage all the time.
yeah. I'm just saying, like, I mean, it's like you're mad about it because you wonder if you like it, right? Like, I mean, that's usually the problem. But but also, I think that sometimes people just sometimes there's just that part of someone that is so conditioned to hate something until they know someone, you know, and a lot of times you don't know. Like, you know, there's something on the internet where they say, oh, we can always tell if someone is trans. Like, you really can't. Like, there are a lot of trans people out there that you just never would have even known. And quite frankly, it's none of your business, right? But, like, mm-hmm. I mean, I just, at the end of the day, I think that you have to just get people to stop, like, I don't know. But at the end of the day, it also has to lay at the feet of the people who are, like, shitting this up. You have the politicians who are, and Chris, I think you have something to say there.
No, go ahead. No, I'll let you finish that point, and then I'll wrap up on something.
Yeah. I think that this does lie at the feet of the politicians who whip this into a frenzy, too. I mean, like, Kim Reynolds knows that trans kids aren't hurting anybody. She mm-hmm. knows that. She's met with a trans, you know, a parent of a trans mm-hmm. child. She knows this. Like,
but her voters won't vote for her if she is supportive.
You know, maybe. I mean, you know, that's the thing.
I mean, that's what she thinks.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
That's the thing. Yeah. It's like, you know, you don't have political courage anymore, even in the face of, you know, people being harmed by some of this stuff. So
let's I want to circle back on this entire conversation and move slightly off politics, but move more towards you living in rural Iowa when you figured out who you were mm-hmm. and things like that. So let's take a break here from Revelton Distilling Company, who, as it were, was Rob Taylor was a state legislature, and he claims that it drove him to drink, which is why he opened up a distillery. So go check out Rob and Christy down at Revelton Distilling Company in Osceola, Iowa. We'll hear from them, and then we'll come back.
At Revelton Distilling Company, everyone has become a part of the Revelton family. From the Taylors and their daughter, who helped perfect their award-winning gins, to the team who installed Lucy, our 33-foot-tall custom-made still, right down to the local farms that provide our coveted corn, and even the cows on those farms who consume our mash byproduct. Want to see the farm to flask come to life? Now you can tour Lucy and find out where we take Iowa's harvest and transform it into our finest spirits. Choose between a 45-minute tour or find out even more by scheduling a VIP behind-the-scenes tour to get the taste of the full Revelton experience. You can visit them at 1400 West Clay Street in Osceola, Iowa, or find all of Revelton's award-winning spirits at any local grocery or spirits retailer.
Okay, and we're back. I had posted, as I had said earlier, CJ, my son Tyler is transgender, was born Taylor. And even to this day, as much as I know who he is and what he does, I still sometimes slip and call him Taylor. So, but during this debate last year with the trans female athlete bill that came out, I made a statement about the fact that I can remember when Tyler was struggling in middle school and was coming home every day crying because he was teased for who he was and so on and things like that, and me not knowing how to help him and watching him hide that he was cutting himself and things like that. And Bill, that goes to what we're talking about. He wasn't having mental health problems because he was transgender. He was having mental health problems because he couldn't find the help for anybody to understand him. Mm-hmm. Including me at the time. I struggled with it. I, even though I was supportive of it, as a parent, I didn't know how to handle it. And mm-hmm. I remember telling people, you know, in all the times that I would go to bed at night and worry that I was going to wake up and find him, that he had hurt himself so bad that he wasn't alive anymore, not once did it enter me that he was doing it because he wanted to run on the track team and be faster than all the other. Like, that's an asinine statement.
I love that.
Not once did I worry about what he was going to run in a soccer game.
Oh, now he's really going to get over.
Right. Like, yeah. So knowing as a parent what that was like to watch and not know, CJ, what kind of being in rural Iowa, I can't imagine, and the resources, what was that like for you growing up and when you found who you were and knew who you were?
So I remember the exact moment that I realized that I was gay, and it was seventh grade track. I was running and I just was like, oh, whatever. I realized that I was like attracted to one of the guys on the team, and I was like, oh. And then my immediate reaction was like, oh, I'm never telling anybody this, like, ever. Like,
Right.
taking that to the grave, yeah.
And then I would always, like, in my mind, I would always envision myself always keeping this quiet. I was going to marry a woman, I was going to have kids, I was going to be normal. And I was going to be a Republican politician. Like, I just had it all in my head. Like, that's just how my life was going to go. And so, like, some of these people actually, like, get to the point where they're actually, like, implementing the plan that I had in my head when I was 14
Yeah,
years
and
old.
then you end up in a hotel room with a tweaker in Colorado.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, for me, so then that it turned from that into, like, sitting up at night and, like, praying to God to change me, to fix me, right? I was
Yeah.
like,
I,
Pray the gay away.
well, I mean, seriously, I was like,
Yeah.
I would lay there and I would say, if I will never ever do anything wrong ever again in my life, if you just change this thing, if you just make me right, fix me. And obviously, God didn't fix me because I was fine the way I was, right? But
Right.
I didn't know that, and going through a lot of those things, it shaped who I was. It did create a lot of trauma that I, struggled to get through in my early, teens and my late teens and into my 20s. But the point I always come back to is, if I could have chosen at that age, I would have done it, right? Like, I would not,
Right.
in
Yeah.
any sense of the universe, like, if you gave me a button and you said, if you push this button, you will not be different than other people. You would be great. You would be none. I'm sure your child would say the same. And, like, maybe not now, but at the in the be beginning of all this,
Sure. Yeah.
that's what I'm saying. Like, if someone had said, if you push this button, you will be straight, I would have smashed that thing and broken the damn,
Right.
right? Like, I mean, you
Who
don't. You're,
chooses the heartache and the trouble and the teasing and the just the mental anguish? Who chooses that?
You know,
Nobody
I
chooses that.
was already disappointing my parents enough with, like, my
Right.
parents.
Like,
Yeah.
I just, I just, so to me, at the end of the day, it's just like, when someone tells me that they are trans and it is who they are, I don't understand. I can admit that. I have never lived in in their body and understood what it meant to feel like I was wearing the wrong skin, right? Like, but I also know that they didn't choose that for themselves. That's just who they are. And they're perfect. They're fine just the way they are. And, there are people out there who care for them, who want them to succeed, who want them to be here. And, if you think about it, I saw a post on Twitter the other day that was like, if your suicide attempt had succeeded, how long would you have been gone right now? And there are people saying, like, 23 years, 15 years, whatever. And then there was somebody that said 3 days, and then all the comments after that were like encouraging stuff. And it's so healthy to admit that we are not okay and to do something about it, because, I mean, I understand on all sides of this, on all sides of the mental health equation, there are different factors that weigh in. And sometimes people just really feel like they're in so much pain that they cannot do it anymore. And that's, it's okay to feel that, because that's just what you feel. I'm never going to tell somebody that they're not feeling that, because it's the same thing as, being different in a way that has to do with your gender or your sexuality. Like, I don't know. It's,
Well, I actually, it's funny that you talk about the choosing. We talk about people not, you don't change people's opinion by telling them they're stupid, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of times on these particular issues, you never change, you're hardly ever going to change anybody's opinion. But I do have a friend who actually credits me for changing their opinion for that right there, like we were taught, we were debating whether or not being gay was a choice. I mean, this was like back before gay marriage was legal. Like this was a debate happening, you know? And I remember us talking about it and I was like, why would you choose, you know, this and this and this and this? And the other thing that I said was, when did you choose to be straight?
Yeah.
Like,
right.
I was like, and you know, my friends are all meatheads. So I just kind of, I put it in a meathead kind of way. And I mean, he's not really, but I was just like, dude, your dick decides for you. You didn't, I was like, you didn't, yeah, at no point did you just go, ah, yeah, I decided that I like chicks. Like, no, man, he you decided.
You don't have that like copyrighted, right? Like, I'm going to use that.
Oh, you can totally, I totally want to put that on a t-shirt at Pride or something. So, like, just your dick decides for you on a rainbow tie-dye.
It'd be a great like Pride shirt. Like, my dick told me to be here. Like. But then you have like an arrow pointing at like the person you're standing next to.
Oh, absolutely.
Anyway.
We can get you hooked up.
CJ. Yeah, that's we can get you hooked line. Up. That's what my girlfriend does. She makes all that shit. We're going to have a whole new website.
Oh, my gosh.
But, I mean, it's true, though. I mean, it's a very simple way to put it to somebody. Like, you, at no point did you make a conscious decision to be straight.
Right.
At no point was that a decision that you made.
Right. And honestly, I mean, it was like.
Also, I'd be gay as fuck, by the way. If it was a choice to like flip it around, because I have, I can say this because some of my best friends are gay. No, but like one of my,
this is the HR violation.
A very good friend of mine who I lived with for a while, a gay dude who was always out, always proud, happy, you know, kind of flamboyant, whatever. Like, he was the happiest person that I knew. And he wasn't bogged down by the male-female relationship ever.
Yeah.
And it was like, this is the happiest guy I know. Like, so I used to say it all the time. I wish I was gay, dude, because I would marry you and we would live happily ever after. But...
Well, and you know, it reminds me of there's that comedian at Ron White, he from the Blue Collar Comedy Tour. Like, he said, you know, he said, I went to this gay bar, they're all super happy and having a great time. And he's like, you know why? And then he's like, there's no women around. And I was like, it's just really funny because, like, that was like, that's like, that was like my dad's favorite joke for a while.
Yeah,
it just. I don't know. It's just one of those things where, like, if people can just kind of get out of their own way, I think it's really easy. Like, if my Trump supporting family members can also go to a Pride parade with me, like, you can do it, right? Like, if my 95 year old great grandmother can go to my wedding and understand that it's just a ceremony that's just like any other, right? Like, people can come around to this, like, and at the end of the day, I mean, it helps people live happier, healthier lives because they just get to live as themselves. So
I can remember my dad years ago, and my dad was, Bill, you would have loved my dad because he had no filter whatsoever, zero filter. And I understand it now, the concept of it, but somebody would say something about gay people or whatever, and he'd go, listen, they can haul coal in their mouth for all I care. It's absolutely no skin off my nose. And I would, now looking, knowing what that meant, I'd be like, holy shit, Dad, I can't believe you would say that. But he honestly did not care. It did not matter to him.
Yep.
And it didn't matter. And I think the problem now is that you take the lowest common denominator of fear and you're leading from fear instead of kindness and compassion, which is what I don't understand with all of these supposed boycotts and whatever, when all these companies are doing are just showing that they want to include everyone. And why is that such a bad thing?
Hey, gay people's green is green too. So
that's right.
You know, like,
right.
I mean,
yeah. So
yeah, and by the way, gay people have more disposable income for the most part, statistically.
Two income, zero child household.
Yeah.
But
all right, we're gonna get wrapped up here. We're gonna hear a last sponsor from Brown Dogs Farms, and then we'll wrap up with CJ and get some final thoughts here. So we get a word from Brown Dogs Farms. Check them out at the Farmers Market in Valley Junction on Thursdays and then downtown on Saturdays. They're available at all the full court press restaurants, and you can order them online at browndogsfarms.com.
Brown Dogs Farm are Norwalk, Iowa-made hot sauces and dressings. Brown Dogs Farm was born out of the dream to emulate the simple life of Rob's grandparents, who inspired him with their hard work and abundant gardens. Rob and Amanda set out to create a unique blend of fruit and pepper that would satisfy the part of the brain that craves great flavor without sacrificing the spice of the peppers. Sweet, but still packing heat. With combinations like jalapeno green apple, habanero peach, cherry rhubarb reaper, and other great flavor combinations, there is a spice and flavor that is right for any party or get-together. BDF also has homemade versions of their classic and spicy ranch that are one of a kind. You can order all of those and more online at www.browndogsfarm.com and ask your local grocery to stock up.
All right, we're back and we are finishing up with CJ Peterson. Of course, we're broadcasting live from the Betfred Sports Studio. Check out Betfred for all your online bets. CJ, what are you up to now? What's the future for you?
Yeah, so I actually work in the state auditor's office in Des Moines.
That's a whole nother 30 minutes.
Yeah, that's a whole my husband and I are finishing up a renovation at our new farmhouse, and so we're kind of in between. We have two different houses right now that we're kind of finishing out, the old one to sell, and then, you know, moving to the farm, and it's a whole undertaking, but it'll be a fun little thing, and maybe that's a blog or a whatever. But
did I see that you're moving in close to Templeton? Is that where you're going to be?
So we live in Templeton right now.
So before you leave, can you get some of the good stuff for me? Or
it's actually I can see it right out the window across the street here. it's all right there. So it's a pretty good tour too. So if you ever get a chance to stop by, it's a nice little tour and all that. So
are you commuting to Des Moines every day?
Currently, yeah, 3 days a week. It's about an hour. But then once we're down in down into Audubon County, we'll be right by the interstate, so it'll be about half hour closer. So
that's good. Yeah, that's not that big a deal. Half hour is really kind of a normal, like even an hour is. I would always think of things like driving across town in Des Moines, you know, like 20 minutes or something. Like if I lived in Houston, this would be 2 hours. Like I'm fine.
Right. So, but yeah, I mean, really, we're just living the Iowa dream, right? So, I mean,
are you actually gonna farm? Are you gonna grow things?
I mean, we're gonna grow like happiness. And,
there's gonna be a lot of shiplap.
You know, we'll do some nice things, but we can say we're farmers because kind of, I mean, we're out in the, we're closer to being a farmer than somebody who lives in West Des Moines, right?
Like, yeah, right.
There you go.
Well, and like maybe animals, we have like a bunch of animals, maybe like pets.
Yeah. So we are actually, funny story. We're inheriting two donkeys. So.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
But they are like allergic to grass, so they have to actually eat hay. So yeah, they're like,
going to do you no good.
Well, it's like gluten intolerance for like donkeys or something. So that's a whole other episode too. I just have a friend from high school who like her mom is just like, I don't want the donkeys to like be sold off. So like, you know,
I want somebody to love them.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And They're very needy, you know. They like come up to the fence and they want pets and all that. So,
so they are like women then. So, so you do have women in your life.
So you didn't dodge the bullet like you thought you did.
Hey, I have a mother-in-law. So. Mother-in-law jokes are still funny if you're gay. So.
Right. CJ, thank you so much.
Mother-in-law sees this. I'm joking. I never tell.
CJ, this has been a blast. I really appreciate you coming on, and I want to thank you for everything that you've done for Iowa and that and for what you're doing out there. It means a lot to a lot of people.
Absolutely. Thank you guys for doing the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on, man. We appreciate it.
Yep.
That is another episode of False Starts. Check out all the rest of our podcasts on Three Beards Media. The Hot Mess Wing Chicks opened a new episode today talking a lot about pride. Old Man Strength records this week. And then, Bill, I may or may not have a Hawkeye show coming up this fall with a couple guys. So we've got some stuff in the mix here. So
right on. Hey, stay on after we get off. I got to talk to you about something.
All right. Sounds good. Everybody have a great night. And we are out.